It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne. The housing market has shown some signs of life recently. Existing home sales are up compared to a few months ago. But some question the idea that the housing sector will lead the way to economic recovery. They say there's an untold number of houses waiting in the wings that have yet to hit the market. And the bigger this shadow inventory, the further off a real housing recovery might be. Here's NPR's Yuki Noguchi with the story.
By the official count, there are about 3.5 million homes on the market right now. Given the rate of home sales, that's roughly twice the normal supply.
That could just be the tip of the iceberg.
Stan Humphries is chief economist for Zillow, a real estate website. It's not what's already for sale that worries economists like him. It's the number of homes that might hit the market in months to come.
The portion of the iceberg below the waterline is inventory that's waiting to come into the market at some point, and as it bleeds into the market over time, it continues to put downward pressure on prices.
Shadow inventory comes in several forms. It includes homes in or close to foreclosure but not yet put up for sale, a number that's increasing. It also includes the untold number of homeowners who want to sell their homes but are waiting for the market to improve. In a recent survey, Zillow found nearly a third of homeowners would have considered putting their homes on the market. Nationally, that would mean between 11 and 30 million homes that aren't listed but are on the sidelines waiting. The would-be sellers include people like Jennifer Dalzell. She and her husband bought this 5-bedroom row house just 4 years ago in the shadow of the nation's capital. Her husband's in the military, so they move around a lot.
We have been sent to different places and have decided to rent it because the market's just not good to sell.
Dalzell says she's watched the appraised value of their home plummet, along with their retirement savings and mutual funds. Her husband will be moving to his new gig in Africa without the family, in part because they don't want to sell at what she believes is the bottom of the market.
Because we can wait, we'll wait until we feel that we can get a better price for the house. I think that the market will come back. It feels like there's money out there and people are just sort of waiting, and I guess we're contributing to that waiting game.
There are no records that quantify how many people like Dalzell there are. In fact, sizing up the shadow inventory is tough. Former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan spoke at the National Association of Realtors Conference in May.
Unfortunately, our data are very delayed, and we really don't have a sense of exactly where we are. But
the key question, Greenspan said, is quantifying how many unsold single-family dwellings are available for sale. But it's not clear how many more homes will be heading into foreclosure. If prices keep falling, that number is bound to grow. Just last week, new government data showed the number of homes going through the foreclosure process jumped 22% during the first quarter. The number of homeowners who are seriously delinquent on their mortgages is also up. And delinquencies are growing the fastest among borrowers who had good credit scores. And that's only part of the challenge. As banks take possession of more foreclosed homes, not all of those are listed, sometimes because the banks are holding back inventory so they don't flood the market.
I do know that banks are holding on to inventory, and what they're doing is they're metering them out at an appropriate level to what the market will bear.
Pat Leshinsky is chief executive of Zip Realty, an online brokerage site. He says this strategy has paid off for banks, even if it also pushes a full housing recovery further out.
By not flooding the market, they were getting better pricing on the homes that they owned. And instead of people coming in and offering less than what the prices were, they were ending up in multiple offer situations and getting more for the homes.
Leshinsky says a large shadow inventory is not all bad because it creates a kind of buffer. Having so many people hold back prevents a free fall in home prices. And also, when the economy recovers, he says there will be plenty of homes to buy. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
More now on the conflict between the Han Chinese and the Uyghurs. Sean Roberts is Director of International Development Studies at the George Washington University. He has done research among the Uyghurs of Central Asia. Welcome.
Thank you.
To the program. And first, when we speak of the Han and the Uyghurs, what are the differences between these two groups?
Well, the Uyghurs are Turkic-speaking and they're Muslim. And so, in fact, they really share a lot more culturally and historically with people to the west than with the Han Chinese to the east.
And how far back does the conflict between the Han Chinese and the Uyghurs go?
It goes back at least 250 years. Since the 1750s, essentially, there's been almost constant tension between the two groups.
Is it a fairly bold line between Han and Uyghur, or are there many Sinicized, as they would say, Uyghurs, or intermarriage, that sort of thing?
Well, there are some, but I think that in comparison to the other side of the border in the Soviet Union, you did not have as much Sinification of minorities in China, and particularly among the Uyghurs. Their religions, in particular, kept them separate from the Chinese.
Now, the Chinese tend to describe their role in Xinjiang province as one of modernization and economic development. True?
That is true. And in fact, I would say since the mid-1980s or late 1980s, there's been incredible amount of development in Xinjiang. But that has not always been completely welcome from the Uyghurs, because the model of economic development that's taking place is essentially displacing them from their traditional livelihoods.
But does modernization bring with it the Han Chinese, or have there been Han Chinese for two centuries already in Xinjiang province?
Well, there has been, but traditionally Xinjiang has been a buffer zone for China, and therefore, while there's been a lot of attempts to forcibly bring Han Chinese into the region, only recently with the economic development have people actually wanted to come to the region and really find their riches, because Xinjiang is also the gateway to Western markets, the former Soviet Union, and then Europe beyond that.
Is it rich in resources?
Very rich in resources. It has, in particular, oil, which is very important to China, and it's also the gateway to natural resources in Central Asia. So there's a large oil pipeline coming from Kazakhstan through Xinjiang into China. There's plans for a large gas pipeline from Turkmenistan through Xinjiang into China, and that's very important to the Chinese.
As we heard from Anthony Kuhn, the Chinese government tends to blame what's happening in Xinjiang on outside agitators, that is, Uyghur exiles. First of all, are they active in Xinjiang or Urumqi? And do they favor secession or a breaking apart from China?
Well, a lot of Uyghurs do favor secession, but I think that the majority of people involved in Uyghur political movements around the world realize that that is not going to happen purely from the efforts of Uyghurs, that it's something that would have to have international support.
We hear reports now of terrible violence in Urumqi. Do you find that surprising? Has it been consistent but less covered? How unusual is what's happening there now?
Well, it's unusual in that there has not been an event like this in recent history. It's not unusual because we do know that there is incredible frustration in the Uyghur population, and I think most people have predicted that this would happen. In some ways, we're surprised that this type of thing had not happened previously.
Sean Roberts, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sean Roberts is Director of International Development Studies at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
On Capitol Hill, lawmakers resume work this morning on a bill to overhaul the nation's health care system. House and Senate leaders have pledged to get health bills passed in both chambers before members leave for their annual summer break next month. Still, as NPR's Julie Rovner reports, sometimes Congress acts at its own pace, deadline or not.
When it comes to the health care effort, the expectations couldn't get much higher. Here's how former Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle put it at a recent breakfast briefing.
I think it's fair to say that July is going to be the most historic and consequential period for health reform, perhaps in all of history. Never at any time that I can recall has so much come down to a matter of just a few weeks.
While Congress was out last week for the 4th of July, some key members, or more accurately, their staffs, stayed in Washington to continue working. And they made some progress. The Senate Health, Education, and Labor Committee, for example, unveiled some major missing pieces of its bill, including a requirement for individuals to purchase insurance and employers to help pay for it. The bill also includes a new government-sponsored plan that would compete with private health insurance companies. Rhode Island Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse is a member of the panel.
We have agreed on a public plan option that has the, at this point, unanimous support of the Democrats on the committee across the board, including some of our more conservative colleagues, including some of our very progressive colleagues.
The bill also has a lower price tag, about $600 billion over 10 years, down more than half from an earlier preliminary estimate. The public plan part of the bill, however, doesn't have the support of any of the Republicans on the HELP committee. It's also been a major sticking point over at Senate Finance, the other Senate committee working on the health issue. Finance Chairman Max Baucus of Montana has been struggling to find common ground with his top Republican, Chuck Grassley of Iowa. Grassley's comments on Face the Nation Sunday made it clear, at least when it comes to a public plan, there's no deal yet.
The federal government is in the process of nationalizing banks, nationalizing General Motors. I'm going to make sure we don't nationalize health insurance, and public option is the first step to doing that.
That's leaving some Democrats, including Senator Whitehouse, wondering if Republicans are simply using Democrats' pursuit of bipartisanship as a tactic against them. Republicans, he says,
can move the bipartisanship goalposts around the field all day long and will never catch up. And they can take all the time in the world until this thing dies. And we can't let either of those two things happen.
Other Republicans, however, like former Minnesota Senator Dave Durenberger, think President Obama needs to make more of an impact on the debate. So far, he says, the debate is simply flying over the heads of most of the voting public.
We know that health care costs are high. We know that job loss is related to it. But it's very difficult from out here to translate that into public plans and trillion-dollar savings. And, you know, all the rest of this language of Washington, D.C.
Durenberger says that while health care is an intensely complicated subject, President Obama is more than up to the task of explaining it.
This is the first time we've had a president who has the rhetorical gifts of communicating with the 300-plus million of us about what it might be like to live in a real American health system. If only we could get from where we are today to what that American health system could be.
The House actually seems well on its way to getting its bill to the floor by the end of the month. But if the Senate doesn't pick up the pace soon, chances for a final bill by the end of the year will start to dim considerably. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
The boss is back. That's the word from the Tour de France, where Lance Armstrong is racing again after 4 years in retirement. And today, a dramatic finish to the fourth stage of the race, a team time trial. Lance Armstrong and his Astana team needed to make up 40 seconds for him to take the lead and the yellow jersey. Here's how commentator Phil Liggett called the end of the race.
Even Armstrong at last appears human. He's gritting his teeth as they drive up now, 46:29. They've got to do it. They need to kick very, very hard here. And they've done it by a matter of, oh my goodness me.
Oh my goodness me. It took a while to calculate, but when they did, Armstrong had missed taking the lead by just 18/100ths of a second. John Wilcoxon of Velo News is covering the tour, as he has for 40 years now. He's also the author of a new biography of Lance Armstrong, written with the Cyclists' Cooperation. John Wilcoxon, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Melissa. Thank you.
And it doesn't get much closer than that finish today.
It certainly can't. You know, that's like 1 meter. So, yeah, it doesn't get as close as that ever.
Well, why don't you explain how the team time trial works? They're racing in a group against the clock, right?
Exactly, and the actual time of the team counts towards the individual classification. That's why it's so important. Today there was 9 men on each team starting in the center of Montpellier, and they had a course of roughly 25 miles to race around, and they have to work as a team. And two of Lance's team actually got dropped behind on one of the climbs, and the other 7 had to go on, but they raced so well that they won by 40 seconds over the team of Fabian Cancellara, who had the lead this morning and still has the lead.
Well, let's talk about how Lance Armstrong is doing. He's 37 years old now, coming out of retirement. He's won the Tour 7 times. He's racing against guys who are a whole lot younger. One of his teammates is 11 years younger than he is.
That's correct. And when he announced his comeback to the sport almost a year ago now, he said he thought it might be quite easy to get back into it. 6 months ago, he said that, yes, this might be much more difficult than I thought it would be. And today, he's sort of in between those two things. He's optimistic, but he realizes he's got a very, very difficult task if he wants to win the Tour de France. And the super favorite for the race is his teammate, Alberto Contador, who won the Tour 2 years ago.
What is the dynamic between the two of them, between Alberto Contador and Lance Armstrong?
Well, the Spanish media, who know Alberto very well, they say that Alberto is holding back. He's not really saying what he really feels because he does want to win the race. And Lance also wants to win the race, but publicly he says that Alberto is the leader. And it's an incredible dynamic, and it'll all come to a head this coming Friday when we get to the mountains.
And typically Lance Armstrong would be expected to do really well. He's always done well in the mountains.
He always has done, but this is 4 years after he last did the Tour de France, so it's going to be very difficult for him. There's never been a Tour de France rider as old as this. 36 was the oldest man to win the race before, and that was like 80 years ago. And Contador is renowned as a climber, so the stage on Friday is going to be something that everybody will want to watch, I'm sure.
Well, John, enjoy the rest of the tour.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Reporter John Wilcoxon speaking with us from Montpellier, where he's covering the Tour de France for Velo News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This time of year, you may be spending some free time doing this. Mowing the grass is tedious and repetitive, just the sort of thing you might like to hand over to a robot. Well, you can. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce has this report on the state of robotic lawn mowing.
You know robot vacuum cleaners, those little disc-shaped things that wander randomly around a room? Picture something similar, cruising across your backyard, trimming the grass.
A perfect manicured lawn, beautiful garden, green homogeneous healthy grass. Thanks to RoboMow, a fully automatic lawnmower from Friendly Robotics that does the work for you.
There are several robot mowers out there. This one is distributed by Systems Trading Corporation. Ames Tiedemann is vice president of Lawn and Garden.
The technology is here and it works.
At least if your yard isn't huge and you don't live on a steep hill. He says you have to lay down a perimeter wire, like those invisible dog fences. The robo-mower roams around within that boundary, avoiding obstacles. Tiedemann says you can program the robot to go out at a certain time, mow for a while, and then come back to be recharged.
You could program this to mow every other day, and you're done for the whole mowing season once you set it up the first time.
If these things have been around for a decade, why do you think they're not just like sort of on every lawn out there?
Well, that's a very good question. I should say that we're growing every year. But you have to realize something. There is a class of people out there that actually like to mow the lawn.
I have to confess, I do.
Bob Markovich is home and yard editor for Consumer Reports.
Sometimes I'm cursing and saying, boy, I wish I could do something else. I have to mow the lawn. And yet I have to tell you, there's a certain peaceful solace in mowing the lawn.
Markovich doesn't mow just for that peaceful feeling. Every year, his group tests dozens of mowers, including, recently, the robo-mower and another called the LawnBot.
They really are more labor-intensive than you'd think.
He says they can sometimes get stuck in places, for example, and the grass isn't left with straight lines.
They produce kind of an odd, random pattern that some may not like.
Plus, these machines typically cost more than $1,000.
I think the short and simple answer is that it's still an expensive toy.
Some researchers are working on automatic mowers that are more sophisticated and more powerful. Sanjeev Singh is at Carnegie Mellon Robotics Institute in Pittsburgh. It should be noted that he personally uses an electric push mower for his own small yard at home. Still, he thinks robots could someday save money for businesses like sports fields, golf courses, and professional landscapers.
Those are serious players in the sense that they use their machines all the time.
But something like a golf course needs consistent precision mowing over large areas. To do that, the robot has to know where it is at all times. Singh has been modifying professional-grade mowers so that they drive themselves and keep track of their location using GPS or other systems.
Technically, we were surprised to see how difficult it is to be able to generate a very repeatable kind of a pattern by the mower in sort of undulating terrain.
He's tested prototypes in places like Heinz Field, where the Pittsburgh Steelers play. He says automatic precision mowing is doable.
If we were to build a mower for $100,000, it would be able to cut the grass in most golf courses or most sports fields, but it would not have very good success commercially.
He's currently focusing on ways of making the technology more affordable. Singh has done some of his research with help from a top manufacturer, the Toro Company. Dana Lawn, spelled L-O-N-N, directs its Center for Advanced Turf Technology. Lawn says robot mowing is kind of at the toddler stage now. Still, he thinks it is coming.
You know, our products are getting more and more sophisticated all the time.
He says, consider Toro's current top-of-the-line Groundsmaster 5900.
It's got four microprocessors on it. It's got a network. It wirelessly reports how many hours it's achieved. Computers are driving it.
But, at least for now, there's still a human at the wheel. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.